Hi everyone. So I just wanted to start today's podcast by letting you know that we have Get Doper as our sponsor of today's episode. Now you probably heard me talk about Get Doper quite a bit on the podcast over the past few months. And that is because I've been taking this supplement now for probably 6 months and I really believe in it. I believe that it works. And that's why I keep asking them to come back and sponsor the podcast because I'm hearing from you guys that it's also working as well. So I wanted to let you know that Get Doper is 3 capsules taken once a day. So you take them and then it's done. They are a nutritional supplement created by an ADHD founder purely because he knew what was desperately needed to help him as a neurodivergent individual. So Get Doper includes 16 high quality bioavailable ingredients that support our mental performance, mood, focus, energy, and our brain health. And they also work to support the neurotransmitters, which are the building blocks to dopamine, and strengthen, very importantly, our central nervous system, something that I talk about a huge amount on the podcast. So I know that I'm hearing from many of you guys who are using the discount code, which is KATE10, to get 10% off. And that you're telling me how effective Get Doper has been, which is why I keep reinforcing it back as a sponsor. But it's also been backed by clinical experts, by ADHD experts, such as Dr. Rachel Gow and Sarah Osborne, who know that these ingredients are fantastic for the ADHD brain and the nervous system. So we've got 10% discount. Use the code KATE10. It's getdoper.com, or head to the show notes. You'll see all the information there and the link to get the discount. Now let's get started with today's podcast. Welcome to the ADHD Women's Wellbeing Podcast. I'm Kate Moore Youssef, and I'm a wellbeing and lifestyle coach, EFT practitioner, mum to 4 kids, and passionate about helping more women to understand and accept their amazing ADHD brains. After speaking to many women just like me, and probably you, I know there is a need for more health and lifestyle support for women newly diagnosed with ADHD. In these conversations, you'll learn from insightful guests, hear new findings, and discover powerful perspectives and lifestyle tools to enable you to live your most fulfilled, calm, and purposeful life wherever you are on your ADHD journey. Here's today's episode. Today, we've got an absolutely fascinating conversation, something that I have wanted to bring into the podcast for a while, and it's all about sugar addiction and the connection between that and our dopamine-seeking brains, ADHD, and how we can help ourselves if we do notice that we may have a sugar addiction or patterns of this. And we have a world leading expert on food addiction, and she has written a new book called Sugarless. Her name is Dr. Nicole Avena, and she is a pioneering research neuroscientist and expert in the fields of nutrition, diet, and addiction. She's also the author of several other books on nutrition and early development. And she is also an associate professor of neuroscience at Mount Sinai in New York City and a visiting professor in health psychology at Princeton University. And she received a PhD in psychology and neuroscience from Princeton and completed her postdoctoral fellowship at Rockefeller University. We've got someone hugely experienced, specialized, and I'm really excited to bring her expertise to the podcast. Dr. Nicole Avena, welcome to the podcast. I have got your book, Sugarless, here. It's a fantastic read. And as soon as I got sent it, I thought I really needed to have you on the podcast because I hear such a common thread in the neurodivergent community, especially with a lot of my clients, my community I speak to, that sugar is as addictive as lots of other things in life. Like we talk about dopamine seeking with ADHD, and very often there's addictive patterns, whether it's sugar, it's alcohol, it's shopping, it's working, it's sex, it's all these different things that we have within our brains, this sort of dopamine seeking mentality. And we don't talk enough about sugar and addiction. And I just want to thank you because your book really goes there and helps us understand it. Can I ask where did it come from, your interest in sugar?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I don't have a personal experience where I, you know, struggled with sugar or struggled with food myself. I've been fortunate in the sense that, you know, I pretty much have the standard type of dietary concerns, I guess, that any woman in our modern world would have. But how I came into all this was really through my academic training. So I was starting a PhD program at Princeton in neuroscience, and it was literally day one of the classes and school. And I was meeting with my advisor about what project I would probably work on, you know, for the next 5 years. And it's a PhD, so it's got to be this very big question and this long process. And I, at the time, you know, this was around the year 2001, we were starting to hear a lot about in the US about obesity rates going up. And it was starting to become more of a public health concern. And it just always seemed curious to me because we have all this information out there telling people about what are healthy diets, what do they look like, you know, don't eat these foods, eat your vegetables. And people still found it really difficult to stick to eating that way. And at the time, it was sort of thought, well, if you can't eat healthy, that's because you don't have the discipline. You don't have the self-control. It's your fault. And I started to think, you know, maybe there's something more to this because we now are starting to see all of these high sugar, highly processed foods in our food supply. Maybe the food is doing something to people. Maybe it's getting people hooked. Like people can get addicted to drugs or alcohol. And so it really, that's what kind of kicked it off. And so we started doing some experiments to really just ask the question, can sugar be addictive? And using the criteria for addiction that are out there in the medical community, basically we were able to, over the course of many, many experiments and lots of publications, show that yes, sugar meets the criteria for being an addictive substance.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. You talk about this actually in the book with regards to sort of sugar versus cocaine. And we've got something in our brains called, I'm going to hope I pronounce this right, endogenous opioid system. And that is our pleasure response. And when I hear the word opioid, that is like serious addiction. So would you say that certain brains have a propensity for sugar addiction?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what we've seen through the research. And so what is most likely happening is that there are people who are just born with a genetic predisposition to be sensitive to these dopaminergic stimulants. So that could be just due to pure genetics of, you know, hereditary components, or it could be due to the fact that, you know, things were going on while they were in utero or in early life that, you know, could help to explain that or make those alterations in the brain. And I think that's really what's happening in many cases these days, is that people are being born at this at higher risk, essentially. And normally that would probably be okay, but we are in a situation where we have all of these dopaminergic stimuli all the time. And, you know, it's the food, right? It's, you know, we have our highly processed foods with these exorbitant amounts of sugar in them that are going to cause this release of dopamine in the brain when you eat them. That's like the release of dopamine that you would get if you, you know, smoked a cigarette or used morphine or used a drug. And I think that for many people, that is what can be really compromising for them, because it's not something that you can just stop, right? When we talk about an addiction, I think it's so important that we remember that addiction is not a moral failing. You know, you don't have control, and it's a brain condition. And when we don't have that ability to, you know, just say stop, we don't want to use this or do that, it can really, really make it so much more difficult for people to change their behaviors.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we don't give enough credit to the fact that sugar is absolutely everywhere. You can't go anywhere, gas stations, supermarkets, corner shops, anywhere you're with your kids, for sure, that there is sugar being sold. And, you know, we're trying really hard here in the UK to remove sugar from like the checkout tills and make it further away in the supermarket aisles, all these little things that we can try and hack our brain or trick our brain. But if, you know, you've got an addiction to tobacco or to drugs or to, you know, alcohol, and we're going through that process of trying to get clean, we can try and avoid those areas, those triggers, those, you know, and not go into shops where they sell alcohol or restaurants or bars or, you know, anywhere that sells tobacco. But with sugar, it's just there constantly on you know, TV advertisements, you go to the movies, all of these places. And so what do you think? I mean, are we getting worse as a society? Have we hit that peak? Where do you think it's going?
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar. It's probably worse in the US for sure in terms of the pervasiveness of sugar. It's interesting when I talk about this to people, I, you know, will often give the analogy of, you know, we have a little bit of sugar kind of sprinkled in pretty much everything. You know, it's a little bit here, a little bit there. Could you imagine if we had a little bit of cocaine, you know, in some of these products and a little bit over here, you know, altogether? Yeah, it adds up and it means something and it's damaging our health. But what we're seeing is that with sugar, for some reason, it kind of gets a pass and people just sort of say, oh, well, it's just let the kids have a candy or let them have, you know, it's not taken very seriously. And it wouldn't be an issue if the kids weren't getting sugar all day long from basically everything that they're consuming because there's so much added sugar all over the place. I think that we are at the point where people are starting to step back and look at the situation and realize, like you had just said, you know, you can't go anywhere without having sugar thrown in your face, without it just, you know, you can't even go to the gas station. You can't even go, you know, to the store to pick up, like, you know, office supplies without being offered, you know, candy bars. And so I think that we are now starting to see that people are really starting to get concerned because what's happening is that so many young people, especially children, are developing things like type 2 diabetes, like fatty liver disease. And these are conditions that you used to only see in very sick adults. And now kids, you know, 7, 8 years old are developing these conditions. And so I think that we are at the point where we need to make some changes from a cultural standpoint in terms of how we view sugar. And I think that's really going to be what's going to make the difference is we have to realize, kind of like with tobacco, you know, it used to be okay to smoke cigarettes and there wasn't really any regulation and, you know, everybody kind of smoked because it was just the thing that people did. And then we started to learn about the health consequences of smoking cigarettes. And we started to see people change their minds about their opinions on smoking. And I think that's what needs to happen with sugar. We really need to have a shift.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, you know, maybe we think about our grandchildren and they're going to look at us the same way that we look at people back in the 50s and the 60s, where almost, you know, smoking was encouraged. Everyone smoked in the offices. We smoked while we were pregnant. It was just part and parcel of society. And it was almost kind of like it was made to look glamorous and all these things that we look back and think, just can't believe it. Vaping, you know, is a whole other thing. Unfortunately, it's kind of, you know, we've kind of created a monster in that respect. And I wonder with regards to sugar, we're replacing it with sweeteners and artificial sweeteners, and that's creating another kind of issue in itself. But we may look back in 30 years, 20 years time and kind of think, what were we thinking? Now, my mum was a bit of an anomaly because I was an 80s child. I was born in 1980. And my mum, from a very early age, knew there was something in it with sugar. I think it kind of resulted in her not having a sweet tooth at all. So she just never bought kind of candies and sweets and chocolate in the house. And she always kind of like opted for like the healthy version, whatever was available in the 80s and the 90s, to the point where it would be like my house was just, my friends were just like, oh, I can't eat anything in your house. I wasn't hugely bothered. It didn't kind of impact me because I guess I had similar taste buds to my mum and I don't have such a sweet tooth. Like I don't really crave sugar, but my brother did. And so it just shows genetics and whatever, but that's now been passed on to me. And my kids kind of always shout at me saying, we never have any sweets or junk in the house. And it got to the point where they were going to their friends and they were saying, oh, their sweet drawer was so much better than ours. And we get laughed at and you get called the lentil mum, like in a jokey way. But I'm kind of like, you know, like that's rude because I'm trying really hard to instill good foundations in their choices. But it can go the other way, can't it? And I am. So then what I've noticed that my kids who range between 18 and 9, I don't want them to go the other way. So I now have a drawer where there is some chocolate, not really sweet candy, but there is chocolate and there are crisps and things for them to access. I just don't go crazy. You know, there's so many parents that listen to this podcast and we just don't know what the right thing to do is, the wrong. And yeah, I just wondered what your advice was.
Yeah, no, it's such an important question. And, you know, I can relate. I'm a parent too. I have two daughters, 15 and 8. And, you know, I think that for me, the best thing is to really give them those foundational skills so that they can make proper, healthy choices. And so I think that having them, you know, exposed to some of these things so that they can learn to set their own limits is important, because if you go that direction where you say, no, we're not allowed to have any of this and we're, you know, not having any of it in our home and avoid it at all costs, then I think you do run the risk of the kids not knowing how to act when they are around it, right? So when they go over their friend's house, then they just, you know, go crazy and have tons and tons of candy because they finally get access to it. So what I think is a option that works for the teens, especially in kids, is focusing more on the immediate effects of having too much sugar. So knowing that, hey, you know what, if you're going to eat all these candies, it's actually going to cause inflammation and that's going to give you brain fog and you're not going to be able to do as well on your tests that you have at school. You're not going to think as clearly. It's going to make it more difficult for you. If you didn't have all those sugars, you would have much more clear thought. And then also about the energy of, you know, oh yeah, if you think you're eating these sugars and this is going to help you, you know, to have energy, it's actually the opposite. You're going to have this sugar crash. So then when it's time to play sports after school, you're going to not perform as well as you would if you had had, you know, healthier food to eat.
Yeah.
And kind of really just tuning them into this idea that, yeah, there are long-term effects. But what about the short-term things just right now, like how you're going to feel? Like if you eat all of these sweets and, you know, put these things in your body, you actually are not going to feel as good right now as you would if you didn't. You get that high from the sugar, from the dopamine, but that goes away in an instant. And then you get the low, you get the crash. And so you're living in the crash. And I think when you position it that way, it can make a difference because then they start to see the immediacy of it and, you know, want to live in the moment.
What's interesting is that I've got four kids and two of them are very similar. All four of them are neurodivergent. They've three with official ADHD diagnoses and one who I know is definitely, but it's not been confirmed. And the younger one is the one without the official diagnosis, but she's the most sensitive to sugar. And but she's got the most sensitive nervous system. She's the one that suffers most with kind of like anxious thoughts and worries. And what happens is she thinks she's craving sugar, or she thinks she wants something sugary, or she goes to a birthday party. Like we all know what happens. They get the gift bag afterwards and there's all like sorts of cake and icing and all of that. They have that. She has a huge high that doesn't last for very long and then comes crashing down, but in a really awful way, to the point where she has a meltdown, the whole house goes into chaos. She has complete lack of control over her self-regulation, her reactions. And it can be really, really hard. And so I have to sort of say to her way, way, way before, like go five steps ahead and say, now remember how you feel when you've had the sugar and what happens, and you feel really awful, you have a big meltdown, you lose your temper, then I lose my temper, and then it all goes really horrible. And I'm trying to get her to sort of see that. But why is it that certain brains are more sensitive to this reaction, to this really kind of huge high and then crashing low? And some people can just handle it and not, it just doesn't affect them.
Yeah, I think it comes back to the dopamine. I think that there are certain individuals who have a very highly sensitive dopamine system where, you know, something can excite them a lot, right? And something that, for example, you know, sugar, we've done lots of studies looking at sugar and dopamine, but one study in particular that stands out with respect to this question has to do with a study that we did where we gave the rats that were in our studies sugar to consume. And the control group just had healthy food. And then we gave them all an injection of amphetamine, which is a dopaminergic drug. And when we looked at the dopamine levels, the rats that had been eating sugar showed a greater dopamine release in response to amphetamine. And so this really just shows that the sugar can prime the dopamine system to then become overactivated in response to a stimuli. So if a child has lots of sweets and then they're at a party where there's like chaos and excitement, like that can trigger them then to have this exaggerated response. And I think for some individuals, they are able to then, you know, have some control and be able to calm themselves down. But for many, that's not the case. And it's not something that when we're talking about neurochemical release in the brain and these biological things happening, sometimes when you say, okay, you need to calm down, like that's just not going to work, right? We have to wait for the neurochemicals to restore themselves into the proper balance. So I really think that that's what's happening. And I think it's happening a lot these days to lots of children, lots of adults, because again, we are setting ourselves up for this by our diet. When we're eating a diet that, you know, even things that are healthy these days, like a granola bar, for example, you can have what's marketed to be a, you know, a protein bar or a healthy granola bar as a snack and think that you're doing something good for your health. But the reality is you're binging on sugar. Even if you have a small little piece of a bar, there's a lot of sugar in those. And so you don't have to consume this enormous volume of food for it to be a sugar binge. There's enough sugar concentrated into small amounts of food that most people are binging on it all day long and they don't even realize it. And that binge is spiking your dopamine system that's then going to make it such that when you encounter a stressor or you encounter something else later on, you're going to be sensitive to it and you're going to react in a way that you probably wouldn't have if your dopamine system wasn't so dysregulated by the sugar.
I think it's fascinating what you're saying because, you know, if you liken it again to something like cocaine, that we know people who, you know, take drugs or they're drinking, the way they react is very different. They react to stress differently. They become more aggressive, all these different things. And you can see that, you know, on the same par as sugar. It's really, you know, fascinating and actually very scary when we think about it. And the fact that as consumers, we have such little control unless we are choosing to be really eagle-eyed. We've got time, especially I'm going to talk about women, busy women, working, parenting, doing everything and trying really hard to make healthy choices for their families and for themselves. But actually, everything is going against us. And then we have to have that self-compassion of, unless we have a huge amount of time in our hands to go to the supermarket, pick up everything, look at the back, look at the ingredients, you know, for shopping online, all these things, it can create such anxiety. And I've had this anxiety for sure. You know, we've got anxiety about so many things in life. And, you know, just to kind of cut through to a different story, I met my husband when I was 21 and he was 26. And when he was about 30, he took really ill and we didn't know what was wrong with him. And he basically was like, went from kind of a relatively active young guy working to bedbound. It was kind of like chronic fatigue. He was really poorly. And I had two babies and he couldn't get out of bed. We couldn't fly. We couldn't go on holiday for like 6 months, a good 6 months. He just couldn't do anything. And what we realized was he had fatty liver, he was pre-diabetic, and he definitely had some form of sugar addiction going on that he'd concealed from me. You know, I opened his glove compartment in his car one day and I saw all these wrappers of stuff that I didn't have in the house, sweets, chocolate. Basically, he had a journey to work 30 minutes there, 30 minutes back. And it was his way of like boosting his sugar levels, his energy, maybe because we have young kids, all of that. He wasn't getting enough sleep. And he was supplementing it with sugar, which I knew he was prone to, but I didn't know it was to that level. And I saw, and I remember speaking to the endocrinologist, and he said, you know, if you don't change your diet really dramatically in your lifestyle, you are going to have type 2 diabetes. And he was 30. And he was slightly overweight, but not hugely overweight. We then went to a functional nutritionist, and she put him on a really strict diet and he just didn't have a clue. And we had to start from scratch and he had to learn. And I kind of got a little bit resentful that I was a mum to young kids and managing his health and having to be his like dietitian. And I wanted him to feel empowered and know that the switches that we're making from potatoes to butternut squash to lots of green vegetables and lots of protein, rye bread, full fat yogurt, all these different things that we had to sort of bring into his diet. I needed him to take control of that for him to understand. And so I just wondered what your thoughts were on a middle-class family who have educated, you know, we don't live in a deprived area. I'm not, you know, but it's these sort of stigmas that we have, but actually there's so many people out there who are eating the wrong food and not even understanding the impact it's having on the inflammation in our body. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because there are certainly groups that are disadvantaged that, you know, don't have access to healthy food, that are relying on the corner store to be their grocery store, that doesn't have all those fruits and vegetables. And so they're kind of, in many ways, forced to eat processed foods. And so people live in, you know, what are known as food deserts, and they are certainly challenged in that respect. But I also think there are plenty of privileged people who also are struggling with this issue because of the fact that we're almost like overcome with anxiety around what to eat due to the information overload. When you go to the grocery store, you know, there's like so many different options for buying cereal now, and there's so many different options for pasta sauce, and there's all these different things that we need to make choices about. And it's not always clear which are the better choices, which are the healthier choices. And so I think for a lot of sort of middle-class families, your average family who maybe has the resources, they don't necessarily have the time or, you know, the skill set to figure it out. And I think that's one of the goals of my book, was to really, you know, help people understand how you can kind of systematically chip away at this and change your diet, change the types of food you purchase, change what you're doing on a day-to-day basis when it comes to what you eat, so that it is going to have less added sugar. And that really can be key. And I really think, though, that it's a lot of work, and you have to make time for it. And it's difficult because I think we're already, even especially as women, we're already stretched too thin to begin with, between, you know, working outside of the home, inside the home, with the kids, with the family, like all these responsibilities we have. And now we have this added layer of, now I have to figure out what foods I should buy and what we should eat and, you know, how to basically forage for healthy food. That's the issue. I think that growing up, I mean, I'm similar age to you, and I don't remember my mom ever really struggling to figure out like what to cook for dinner or what snacks to buy or what things to feed us. We just kind of had food and it was all basically healthy. Yeah, there were snacks here and there, but for the most part, it was all pretty much food that was made at home. But now everything is, it's so encouraged to use the convenience foods and to buy these sort of pre-made foods and to really just embrace the fact that we're busy people. So we need to use this sort of like shortcut to just feed our families and feed ourselves. And I think that's part of the issue, is not allowing us to get the time to go to the store, to look around, buy what we need to buy, you know, come home, prepare it, work with the kids to show them how to prepare food. I feel like a lot of that has gotten lost just in the shuffle of our busy lives. And I think we need to get that back.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Absolutely. And that, you know, it goes back to that kind of notion of like, we do need to give ourselves some self-compassion, because we can be wracked with guilt, anxiety, shame that we are so busy that we can't cook from scratch, that we are leaning into, you know, convenience food. Because what's the alternative? You know, we're talking about female mental health. We're talking about women who've got ADHD, who are more prone to overwhelm, who are more prone to anxiety and stress and mental health issues. And with executive functioning as well, we are often on the back foot from a societal perspective in the home. And Sarah Solden, who writes a lot about women with ADHD, she talks about these sort of she messages that where we're not keeping home properly, we're not cooking properly. Look, our kids' drawers and school bags aren't all done to the way we have been told as women we should have these standards. then we crumble. And then now we've got lots of dietary messages coming at us saying we need to be cooking from scratch and making sure our kids are healthy. And then very often, as neurodivergent women, we've got neurodivergent kids, and we know we're learning more and more about the impact of brain health and feeding our brain healthily and using diet and exercise and meditation and calm and mindfulness, all these things that are being thrown at us on top of full-time jobs. And with this generation of women who are sandwiched between absolutely everything, and I hope that the next generations, we are more compassionate on ourselves and we do have more leniency with regards to what expectation we put on ourselves. But right now, we do need to choose like mental health, looking after families, looking after ourselves. So where would you say are these kind of these ways that we can help reduce maybe some of the stressors and help reduce the sugar and just give ourselves a bit of compassion in this kind of lessening the sugar journey?
Yeah, I think it's so important that, you know, we focus on the fact that, like you said, this isn't an all or nothing approach. And I think that the sooner that women can get on board with that about all aspects of life, then the happier we're all going to be. With the book especially, and with reducing sugar, I am a big advocate for taking small steps. And the psychology research tells us that if you really want to have change in your behavior, you can't just wake up one day and do everything from anew. You have to take small steps. Small incremental changes are the ones that are actually going to work. And I think from the diet perspective, we already know this because, you know, everybody has tried this diet and that diet. And if you don't stick to the rules, then you failed the diet and you just say, oh, forget it. I'll just, you know, not even bother eating that way. And I'll try something else in a couple of weeks. And so the diet culture has kind of set us up with this sort of all or nothing thinking that if you don't do it right, you're not doing it right and just forget about it. And so that's why I was very clear in the book about making sure that, you know, it's about small changes. And so, for example, you're not going to wake up and throw all the sugar out in your house, but maybe you're going to say, okay, well, you know, in the morning, the very first thing I do is get myself a cup of coffee. And normally I add creamers or sugar or whatever it might be, but now I'm going to edit this. And I'm going to say, you know what, I'm going to try to have my coffee with less sugar or less of the creamer, or maybe I'll use, you know, milk instead that doesn't have any added sugar. And it's about making these small changes. And then once you say, oh, you know what, I made that change and I had less sugar and I still enjoyed my coffee. And yes, was it as delicious as the one with all the, you know, creamers in it? No, but I still had it and it's fine. Then you can move on to the next thing. And, you know, it's just really sort of a slow approach, but it works. And that is what's going to make the difference. It's not about, you know, radically cutting out all of the sugar overnight, because that's not reasonable. And that's going to set us up for failure. And so that way we have some built-in flexibility into what is going to happen in our life, in our dietary choices. You know, if you go out to a restaurant and you decide, you know what, I see a piece of cake, it looks beautiful, I would love to have a piece of that cake. Okay, well then you should be able to have that piece of cake and not have this guilt and this feeling of, oh, I can't have that. But if you've been able to reduce your sugar intake in other places, then why not enjoy the cake, right? And so that's really the messaging I think that I'm hoping we'll get through to people, is that, you know, we have to be gentle with ourselves. And if we spend all this time beating ourselves up because we, you know, didn't follow these, you know, very rigid rules, then nothing's ever going to change. And we're just going to be in this vicious cycle of guilt. And that's not where we want to be. And so it's really about those small incremental changes that you can make throughout the day. And over time, they're going to stick and make a big difference.
Yeah, because you talk about withdrawal. It's quite a big deal, isn't it? The withdrawal from sugar, especially if we believe we have a sugar addiction or we are regularly binging on sugar. And, you know, like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, disordered eating and binge eating specifically with sugary food it's talked about a lot in the ADHD community. There's a very direct link. And very often now, I hope that when people are going into facilities to really sort of help them with their disordered eating, and it's, you know, with binge eating, they are screening for neurodivergence because of the dopamine receptors and, yeah, and having much more sort of sensitive behavior with that. But I just wondered what you would say about someone. Would you say that it has to be small and incremental, because it goes against other addiction right. kind of advice, doesn't it? You know, like with drinking and drugs and all of that,
yeah.
gambling. Can we completely have a sugar-free life?
Yeah. So I think that there's two things. Yes, you're right that typically when we think about addiction, we do have that sort of all or nothing approach where you have to abstain. If you are an alcoholic and you can't control yourself around alcohol, then you shouldn't drink alcohol. If, you know, you are using drugs, you should not use them, and, you know, avoidance. I think that a harm reduction approach is really a better way to think about this when we're talking about sugar, because it's very clear if you want to avoid alcohol, you just don't buy it. You don't bring it in your house. You don't go to the restaurants that serve it. You know, you tell the people around you, I am not drinking. But sugar is very different. You know, sugar's hidden in all of these different foods that we're eating. Could you imagine how it would be for alcoholics if everything they drank, they didn't know alcohol, somebody put a little alcohol in their coffee and they didn't know it was there. It's so difficult to completely avoid it. And that, you know, it's so pervasive in our society that I think that for some people, yes, they fall on that extreme side of things where they do need to actually abstain and completely cut it out. But I think that a lot of people are more in the middle or have a mild addiction where they are definitely struggling to manage it, but they are able to do so in a way that if they can just reduce it and get that control back, then they can be healthier. And I think that's really what it comes down to is, you know, understanding that if you don't have control or you don't feel like you can get control, then you really have to work on this, because that's what we want, is to regain the control over what we're choosing to eat and not be drawn to binge and be drawn by our cravings and really be able to be the ones who make the decisions about what we're eating. And it can be difficult. And I think sugar in particular, you know, not only is it so pervasive, but like you said a little earlier, it's the sweets are one part of it, you know. There are sugars in fruit, there are sugars in, you know, other things that are maybe healthy for us, right? Yeah. And so a lot of times people who are struggling with addiction to the added sugar, like the cakes and the cookies and the sweets, they find that the sugars that are actually natural in fruits will be helpful to them. So when they have a craving, you know, instead of eating the cookies, they can grab grapes or, you know, an apricot or something that's got natural sugar in it from fruit. And that can satisfy that craving, and that can be helpful because the fruit has fiber in it. It's got other nutrients in it that are designed to support our health. So I do think that it's difficult with sugar because it is just, you know, so complicated. And again, you know, people will often say, well, when I talk about our work on food addiction, because we focus on sugar a lot, but we don't eat sugar by itself. We eat food that contains sugar. You know, one of the pieces of pushback I'll get is, well, you know, you need food to survive. So how do we avoid it if we're addicted to it? And I think it comes down to you're not avoiding all foods. You're obviously avoiding the foods that are your triggers. So for example, when I talk to people who are going through this and trying to manage their addiction to sugar, if you're addicted to cookies, like if cookies is your trigger food, meaning you can't just have one, that's your downfall, that's the thing that you really just have a hard time controlling your intake of, then I say don't eat them, don't buy them. That's, you don't need cookies to survive, right? So we have plenty of other things that we can eat. So I think it really comes down to managing what we can control and then working where we can within that to then really just reduce, get the added sugars down to as low as we can.
Yeah, that's really helpful advice. we can touch on this before we finish, but as women who are, we're cyclic beings, we are hormonal, we've got hormonal changes, and there's certain times of the month and certain times of our life where sugar may feel like something that we just need. It's like a bit of a hug, and being okay with that. If we're about to get our periods and we're craving some chocolate or popcorn and we just want to sit on the couch and veg, to know that's okay as well. As long as we're not doing it every single night, you're binge eating lots of chocolate, but just to have that recognition that it's okay to have some ebbs and flows into sort of harder days where maybe sugar might be more of a crutch for us, and being okay with that, but knowing that if it's long-term, every day, consistently, in a sort of unhealthy way, yeah, then we might need to take a close look at that.
Yeah, I think that's so true and spot on. And I think one thing that can really help is, you know, we know that we use sugar to self-soothe, right? We know that we use it to self-medicate. It's a fact. And maybe that's okay. And maybe the way that I approach this often is to tell people, you don't take medicine every day, right? You take medicine when you need it, right? And so if we find that we're in a situation where we're taking sugar as our medicine every day to make us feel better, then that's something to work on, because we should create a life where we are able to manage it for the most part, and we don't need to rely on the sugar to help us get through it, to help us feel better. However, we are obviously going to have those times where, oh, you know what, I'm just having that day and I really would like to have something to comfort me and, you know, lay on the sofa, like have a little ice cream or just do that. And that's totally fine. But I think when we put in the work throughout our day-to-day life to try to make those changes so that we're reducing sugar here, reducing it there, that way, when we do have that moment where we want to indulge, we don't have to have any guilt over it, because we know that, okay, you know what? I've put in the work and I've made the changes in my life to be healthy for the most part, right? And do what I can for the most part. And now I'm going to take a moment and maybe, you know, use the sugar in a different way. And that's how I kind of view it. And you're so right. It's about just being gentle with ourselves, forgiving with ourselves, and just knowing that if we're putting in the effort and trying our best and making these, again, it doesn't have to be these huge sacrifices, these small things that we do, then that's great. And that's moving in the right direction. We're on a journey and we're going down that road. And even if it's a small step that we're taking, we're still going in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes this restrictive mentality can make things worse. And, you know, like I was just talking about all the stresses and stress in life, and sometimes those moments of connection, where it's birthdays, it's anniversaries, we're with friends, we're on holiday, like we need these kind of moments of fulfillment. And very often it comes with a meal. It comes, you know, whatever religion or culture you're from, very often it culminates in a meal. And to, you know, sometimes it's just lovely to have a cake or lovely to have dessert and sit around, you know, with the family, and to know that's okay as well. And to know that these moments of connection are very important for our health, reducing inflammation and stress, and not worrying too much about, oh my goodness, there's dessert and this and that. So I'm just thinking out aloud, because I just see all these different ways it weaves into our life in these sort of very nuanced ways. And just being aware of that and having those moments of, I'm going on holiday. This is a holiday that I've worked really hard for. It's time for me to connect with my partner, my family, my friends, whatever. And maybe for this week, it's okay for me to have an ice cream, and it's okay for me to sit around the table and have dessert and talk until midnight and all these lovely things that we look forward to all year. But yeah, I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you for this fantastic book. Thank you for creating more awareness around this topic, and also for the great recipes and the breakdown and really helping us understand so we can make more empowered choices. Because I think that's where we need to come from now, is like having education around this topic.
It's, again, thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed talking with you about this, and I'm so glad that you're, you know, bringing this information, you know, out there and helping people to better understand, you know, about how changing your diet can really change your life in many different ways for the better.
Fantastic. Well, just to say that your book, Sugarless, is available now, available everywhere. And is there another way that you work? Do you see people in clients privately? Do you do talks? What else do you do apart from the book?
Yeah. So I do quite a few things. I'm a professor, so I teach at the university here in at Princeton. And I also do a lot of nutritional consulting. So if you go to my website, drnicolelavina.com, you can learn all about that. And yeah, I lecture a lot to different organizations and groups. I'm actually going to be coming to the UK in May to present a conference on food addiction. So So it's great to spread the word about the research.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
I really hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you did and it resonated with you, I would absolutely love it if you could share on your platforms or maybe leave a review and a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And please do check out my website, adhdwomenswellbeing.co.uk, for lots of free resources and paid for workshops. I'm uploading new things all the time and I would absolutely love to see you there. Take care and see you for the next episode.